This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Pushing Daisies, the ABC series about a pie maker with a touch that can restore life, is up for 12 Emmys Sunday night. Also, the show's first season came out on DVD this week, and the second season begins October 1st. Today, we'll talk with Brian Fuller, the creator of the show, and Barry Sonnenfeld, the director of the pilot episode. Both of them are nominated for Emmys. Barry Sonnenfeld also directed the Addams Family and Men in Black films, as well as Get Shorty. He started his career as a cinematographer and shot several films for the Coen brothers, including Blood Simple and Miller's Crossing. Brian Fuller broke into TV by writing for two series in the Star Trek franchise. Then he created the cult TV shows Wonderfalls and Dead Like Me, and also wrote and produced for Heroes. Pushing Daisies revolves around a young man named Ned, played by Lee Pace, who's also up for an Emmy. Ned has the unusual and unexplained gift of bringing dead people back to life with a single touch. Here's a scene from the pilot, which is now out on DVD. Ned works with a private detective on unsolved murders. Their current case is the murder of Ned's childhood sweetheart, a woman nicknamed Chuck. In a funeral home, Ned awakens Chuck from the dead. But unless he touches her again within a minute and takes her life away for good, someone else will die.
Chuck, wait!
Who are you?
Do you remember the little boy who lived next door to you when your dad died?
Ned? Oh my God, hey, how are you?
Good, you look great. Do you know what's happening right now?
I had the strangest dream. I was being strangled to death with a plastic sack.
You were strangled to death with a plastic sack. That's probably an odd thing to hear, but I wasn't quite sure how to sugarcoat it.
Oh.
You only have a minute. Less.
What can I do in less than a minute?
You can tell me who killed you, so, you know, justice can be served.
Well, that's really sweet, but I don't know who killed me. I went to go get ice, and I dropped my room key in the ice maker, and as I was thinking, that was dumb.
As she was thinking that was dumb, Chuck was strangled to death with a plastic sack.
And then you touched my cheek.
What's going on here?
Just a second!
Is my time up?
I'm sorry.
Well, thanks for calling me Chuck. Do you know no one's called me Chuck since you?
I used to. When I lived next door to you, I had a I was in. You were my first kiss.
Yeah? You were my first kiss, too. You want to be my last kiss? First and last? Or is that weird?
That's not weird. It's symmetrical.
I spoke with Barry Sonnenfeld and Brian Fuller last fall and began by asking Brian Fuller to describe the premise of Pushing Daisies.
The story is about a young man named Ned who is a pie maker, and he discovers as a child that he has a gift that he can touch dead things and bring them back to life. But this gift has a caveat or two, and those caveats are if he touches the dead once, they come back to life. If he touches them again, they go back to being dead and dead again forever, never to be revived. And the third caveat is if he lets a dead person live for longer than a minute, then someone else has to die. And he decides in our pilot that his childhood sweetheart, when she dies, she deserves to be brought back for good and makes a decision to let somebody die to get his lost love back.
Now, every time I describe this to people, after telling them that I think it's my favorite new show of the fall, they look at me like I'm slightly deranged. But once you get past that initial description, can you talk about why it is that you're able to hit grace notes that make this more intelligent and witty and less just sci-fi strange than it sounds?
I think it just goes to the characters and the character relationships. So we're all wanting to be in relationships, and we all want someone to love in our lives, and all those relationships are going to come with complications. And if the basic complication is that you can't touch each other, then it forces you to get to know somebody and be intimate in a way where you don't have the hurdle of physicality to get over, because it's never an option.
Part of what's so charming about the pilot is the visual look which Barry, you bring to it as the director, or are greatly involved in bringing it as the director. How do you collaborate together and with the costume designer and with the lighting designer and with the actors even to make sure that everybody's on a uniform tone for something that's kind of like a fable.
Well, for me, and this is Barry talking, for me, the definition of a director is a sort of the tone police, and a director has to decide what the tone of a show is going to be and then make sure everything is consistent to that tone, whether it be the lighting, the camera angles, the nature of the way actors talk, the pace in which they talk, the way the camera covers the way those people talk, the costumes they wear. And again, based on Brian's script, the tone to me was quite obvious, although I will say that the tone is a very narrow bridge to walk on in this show, that it could have gotten too jokey or too sad or too silly. So Brian's script sort of defined the tone. It was my job with Brian to maintain that tone in everything from visual effects to camera angles to lighting. But that's the job of a director.
And why the focus on so many stage actors? This is by no means a complaint, but you have Kristen Chenoweth, Swoozie Kurtz, Ellen Green, some really remarkable talent there in supporting roles.
It really wasn't any sort of intentional agenda to get a lot of stage actors. I think it was the training of stage performers is more conducive to the tone of the show. And you know, I used to work on Star Trek for many years, and we often found that since Star Trek was a heightened reality, that we would cast a lot of stage actors because they found a way to make that heightened reality emotionally real. And so with Kristen and Swoozie and Ellen and Anna and Lee, who all have a lot of stage training, they made the heightened reality real.
Barry, let me ask you a question about the Coen brothers. You started as a cinematographer on Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, which is one of my absolute favorites. And I'm wondering, did you develop and absorb their style, or did they develop and absorb yours?
Joel and Ethan Coen and I worked on our first three movies together. In fact, the first time I had ever been on a movie set in my life, or the Coen brothers in their lives, was the first day on the set shooting Blood Simple. None of us worked our way up. We just sort of got lucky and raised some money and made the movie. And I had done a lot of still photography work before that and loved the wide-angle lens. I thought it had a real energy to it. And so we developed a look together, and, you know, I learned a lot from them and they learned a lot from me, but it was really incredibly collaborative, very much the way it is now with Brian and myself on Pushing Daisies.
One thing that you do in your films as director that seems to carry on to the television program is to trust your actors a great deal, to have some scenes go in wide frame where we get to see what two or three of them are doing at a time, and to trust them to act. Is that an accurate assessment, and is that something that you're doing intentionally?
That's an incredibly astute question, and I'm going to take a minute to answer that. First of all, I think great comedy plays in two shot because you have action and reaction in the same shot. If you look at all the screwball comedies by Preston Sturges or Howard Hawks, you've got Cary Grant in a bathrobe, and you've got Katharine Hepburn calling him Mr. Bones, which isn't his name, and Bringing Up Baby. And the only reason, or part of the reason that works, is because it plays out in a two-shot. You have Cary Grant reacting while Katharine Hepburn is being hysterical in the same shot. It requires really good writing, first of all, so that you don't need to cover the scene in order to edit out the bad words or the stuff that you cringe when you read it going to work that morning. And then, in addition, the director has to pace the actors to give you the comic pacing in that shot, so you don't have to try to pace up the scene later by covering the close-ups. But I find a lot of comedies are shot in a really lazy style with a lot of close-ups, and I never want to cut to the punchline of a joke. I want the audience to think they're smarter than me, mm-hmm. so that they see where the joke is, and it's as if they don't even know that I knew where the joke was. I like them to discover where the joke is.
My guests are Brian Fuller, the creator of Pushing Daisies, and Barry Sonnenfeld, the director. They're both executive producers. What were the first movies or TV shows you saw that really sparked your imagination?
I would say one of the biggest influences on my writing and imagination was The Twilight Zone. It's, you know, very often they were one-act plays that had characters that were reacting very realistically to incredibly absurd situations, and they always kind of had an emotional realism to them, but we were allowed to see this fantastic world that wasn't contained within the parameters of reality.
Well, Barry, same question to you.
I came very late to movies because I had this painfully shy childhood. I wasn't a movie goer. I was profoundly thin, couldn't get a date, and didn't want to go to movies by myself. And B, the only thing you would see at movies was people falling in love and having dates and getting married. So, and I knew that wasn't going to happen to me either. So I came very, very late to movies, and the movie that to this day is my favorite movie that was one of the first movies I saw was Dr. Strangelove.
Oh,
which
wow.
is as black a comedy. You never want to tell anyone you're making a black comedy because the studios never want to make black comedies. I remember trying to get a movie made at Paramount after Addams Family did over $100 million, and the head of the studio was saying, well, you know, we don't make black comedies here. And I said, well, kind of Addams Family. So, but I'm a big black comedy fan, and Strangelove is my favorite movie.
Well, that's really interesting because Kubrick films most of the scenes in Strangelove in exactly the way that you've described as you preferring to set up your comedy scenes.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. One of the things that makes Strangelove so great is to see Sterling Hayden and Peter Sellers in the same frame, looking in the same direction with Jack D. Ripper explaining why, you can't drink water and milk and, you know, the whole purity of essence mm-hmm. thing. So that movie is often played in the Comedy 2 shot, and what makes it hysterical is seeing action and reaction in that same shot. So when I mentioned Howard Hawks and Preston Sturges, I should have also mentioned Kubrick as he directed Strangelove.
Your jobs, your first jobs in what we could call show business.
I know where this is going, Dave.
You don't even know.
That's so cheap.
Listen, Dave. You don't even know to whom this question is directed yet, because both of you guys broke in, if my information is correct, in fairly unorthodox and very different fashions. And I was just going to ask, who wants to go first?
I want Brian to go first.
I started in porn. And that's actually a segue into Barry's story, yeah. So I'll let him go. That was very passive-aggressive of me.
And I wasn't going to mention it. When I got out of film school, I thought I had some talent as a cinematographer, so I thought if I owned a camera, I could call myself a cameraman without being sort of effete about it. So I bought a used 16mm camera, and the first job I got was shooting 9 feature-length pornos in 9 days. The 9 days were so sexually disgusting, perverse, and, my theory is if porns included the sense of smell, no one would ever go see a porn again.
Well, thank you for sharing that. So Blood Simple would be the first thing on your resume.
Actually, Blood Simple would be the second thing. I shot a documentary called In Our Water.
That was nominated for an Academy Award.
No. I love documentaries, and in fact, it helped me discover a certain style of shooting involving sort of wide-angle lenses, and it's a different way of shooting documentaries. But Blood Simple was the first time I was a cinematographer on a feature film for the Coen brothers.
But didn't
shot
you get
in Austin, Texas?
Didn't you get Blood Simple because of your work on the documentary, though?
Oh no, I got the job on Blood Simple because Joel Coen and myself were the only two Jews at a party filled with wasps on the Upper East Side one night, and we sort of smelled each other from across the room and came together. And we discovered that we had both gone to NYU film school, although we didn't know each other then. And he was telling me that he had just written a script for Blood Simple, and he was going to shoot a trailer as if it was a finished film and use that as a technique to raise money. And I said, hey, I own a camera. And he hired me that night, and we went off and shot the trailer of that would have become the trailer for Blood Simple. And a year later, we were on a movie set. But no, it was merely because I owned a camera that Joel Cohen found me that night and hired me.
Wow. Which scenes were used in the trailer?
Well, because we didn't have any actors yet, you know, because we hadn't raised the money, it was shot in a very sort of stylized way. So we shot the yellow lines of a road. And you know the scene near the end of Blood Simple where Emmett Walsh shoots holes through the bathroom.
Oh, yes, sure.
Wall, and you see those beams of light. So we recreated that, but we didn't have what are called squibs or any explosives. So we cut big round holes in a wall and then patched them up again. And then while I dollied in on the wall, a guy in the back, Don Wigman, behind the wall, was hitting the holes with a hammer. And that's how we created. You know, the plugs went out so fast, you didn't see them in the darkness. So, you know, the funny thing is, we then shot Blood Simple and had a real professional guy with squibs and explosives, and we set the holes according to a specific pattern, and it didn't look nearly as good as it did with, as compared to Don Wigman with a hammer in the back of the wall.
And Brian, if you still remember the question,
Dave.
Yes, I'd like you to answer it in terms of no. I'm just saying the way that you broke into the business was very unusual. It may have smelled better, but.
it was much more olfactory friendly. I submitted a spec script to Star Trek Deep Space Nine and got invited in to pitch. So there was a time when Star Trek had an open script submission policy, at which they which went away shortly afterwards because of the lawsuits. But I managed to get in under the gun with folks like Ronald Moore, who you know reimagined Battlestar Galactica for mm-hmm. the Sci-Fi Channel, and it was a great way to get into writing. And I saw the show, I liked the show a lot, and I decided to write a spec script, and I did, and it got me in the door, and I sold a couple of stories, and then they gave me a script, and I was on staff for 4 years.
Can you define what a spec script is?
Oh, a spec script is something that you write that you're not getting paid for, and oftentimes writers will use them as a resume. It's a sample of your work that shows that you can actually write a script, and there's two ways to do it. You can either write an original spec script, which is basically a pilot that hasn't been ordered, but a pilot that you would like to see and like to write. And the other one is to look at a show, an existing show like Desperate Housewives or Ugly Betty, and write an episode that you come up with and give it to people. So it's a writing sample.
And what did you learn most in terms of doing television, and specifically fanciful television?
I got into writing to become a Star Trek writer. I was a rabid fan. I had shelves and shelves and shelves of action figures in my bedroom that scared away more dates than I care to admit to. And so it was really, if back then you told me you're going to write for Star Trek for 20 years, I couldn't have imagined a happier career. But after writing for Star Trek for 4 years and bumping up against the parameters of the storytelling, which sometimes were very restrictive because there was always that magical reset button and you could never carry story arcs over the episodes because they were so heavily syndicated that it just simply wasn't allowed. I began to get itchy and wanting to tell stories with a little more emotional depth, because one of the things about the Star Trek universe, especially the Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and Voyager, were that the characters were so much more evolved than we were that they wouldn't be terrified when they're looking at a giant Borg cube about to assimilate them. They would handle their jobs and they would behave responsibly and calmly. And I just had a hard time relating to that after a certain point. And then my last year on Voyager, I wrote Dead Like Me on spec.
Brian Fuller, Barry Sonnenfeld, thank you very much for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave.
Brian Fuller and Barry Sonnenfeld in a conversation from last fall. Both of them are up for Emmy Awards Sunday for their work on Pushing Daisies. The first season of that ABC comedy series has just come out on DVD.